The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Alistair Coburn. You're listening to Agile Uprising Podcast.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I am your co-host for the evening, Jay Hursko. With me, I have our esteemed board member, Ryan Lockhart. Say hi, Ryan.
Hello.
And this evening, we have a very special guest. We have the change management guru, author extraordinaire, Jason Little. Jason, thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me.
So I think we want to get this ball rolling. So Jason, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I am the world's greatest Cold Fusion developer. And
he came out swinging.
I might have a contract for you, actually.
So I started as a developer in the 90s and then realized I wasn't very good at it. So got into project management and then into management and then agile coaching and consulting in the, the mid-2000s or so. And most of my experience started off with big companies, so I quickly ran into a lot of the organizational problems that I see companies running into with Agile nowadays. So that was sort of the trigger for me to get more involved in the organizational change base over the years. So that's the Reader's Digest version of about me.
Yeah, so your book is Lean Change Management, and I know you put forth like a whole bunch of new concept. Newly framed or newly scoped concepts in there, but I think to delve into that, can you start by explaining what traditional change management is for in your own words for the folks that may not be super familiar?
Sure. So more often than not, it's associated with IT change control. When people hear that term, change management, there's a whole universe of organizational change and organizational development that if you talk to that crowd, they don't usually associate themselves with change management, but it's more about, not just IT control and change in IT projects, but how organizations change from a process perspective or business readiness or reorganizations. And I would say they come from more of a project management space in general. So, I see lots of debates in the traditional community around, is it time to merge change management with project management? Or what's the difference between this and that? So it comes from a very kind of traditional, more structured, fixed mindset. It's not universal, but typically when people hear that term, that's what they hear.
So traditionally, what type of projects would go through a change management model, or would an organization employ change management to see through?
It's a wide variety of stuff. So it might be a change group that is helping filter through a reorg. So moving people around to departments, creating new departments, stuff like that. Also big system implementation. So I'm working with an organization now that's doing a 2-year long systems replacement. So the change management group, more or less, we're focusing on the 8,000 people that are affected by the implementation of the system and all of their organizational-wide business processes. So it could be a mix of bringing in a new system. It could be bringing in a new process. I worked in one organization where the change management team got involved in the Agile transformation. So they helped with some of the people side of the change with some more traditional models.
Cool. That's interesting because my enterprise level experience has always been when everybody looks at change management, somehow it gets lumped into release management. And I don't know where that ever came from, but oh, the change guys, they create the change tickets. And your book, which one of the things that caught, that hooked in my brain was it talked more about the organizational change and growth that comes. It's not just creating a ticket to make a code change. It's really about changing your entire landscape enterprise wide. which I think when you just rattle off change management to someone who may not be as knowledgeable, they probably might just assume it's, you know, the right hand to the least management left hand.
Yeah.
So do you remember, I guess you said you start off in development, moved into project management, then into more general management roles. Do you remember your first change project where you realized that this was something that you you really felt drawn to? And what was that project?
It was working in a large organization where I had been working with one of the pilot Agile teams. So I was brought in to be a Scrum Master for that team. And then another project kicked off, and I still remember the room, the office where I had this conversation with the director of the PMO and the senior manager of development. And they said, well, yeah, we're going to do this as an Agile project. It's really important to the company, blah, 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 blah. We don't want Agile to get in the way. And so back then, all I had was, well, there's only four values. Which one of those do you want me to break and not do? There was no concept about what they were actually saying was, when this project goes to hell, we're the ones that are going to get yelled at. We don't want that to happen. So I just was totally clueless about the organizational impact that that Agile was having, which sparked a blog post that I wrote back in 2009 that just reaffirmed my beliefs that Agile is not the point, never has been the point. There's something else out there that is going to help organizations make sense of how Agile is sort of blowing up their organization. And that kind of got me started down the path of more organizational change and looking at ideas from kind of the other side of the fence.
Right. So your book was, I cheated and just looked at my copy, but your book was published. It was published in 2014. Yeah.
Yeah. The second version of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, someone even had the first edition. Cool.
So the first edition was on LeanPub. So it was chapter by chapter, to get the ideas out there. And it was spawned from, if you've seen the live lessons, the Pearson live lessons, the stuff that are on, that's on Front Row Agile nowadays. So the live lessons I did on Agile transformation sort of launched that live lessons brand. And that was after that blog post. And that sort of fed into the first version of the book that I did chapter by chapter. And then the one in 2014 was the total rewrite from start to finish. Yeah.
Right. So when did you publish chapter one on LeanPub?
Roughly
what year?
Probably 2012.
Yeah.
Maybe end of 2011, 2012. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think you answered actually the original intent of my question when I had the wrong year of publishing. By the way, that's one of my calling cards with this podcast, is I always get something wrong. So I'm glad I got it out of the way early.
The Ryan Lockard, the Ryan Lockard brain fart, edit it in post that we never.
You are, yeah. So the Jason Little podcast is now Ryan Lockard certified.
Nice.
So the reason I was asking is I was going to say, what were you doing to codify your lean change management stance between 2009, when you were in that conversation with that executive about the agile transform, air quote, agile transformation,
yeah,
and the issuing of the book. But it sounds like you were doing that agile transformation web series. Yeah.
Yeah. It was supposed to be a book sooner. So I had done a talk at Agile 2010 or 11. And somebody from Pearson Education was in the audience. And my session was about how to get started with Agile when you don't know where to start. So it just stripped away all the noise and the BS and the buzzwords and stuff. And he said, no one is really talking about the organizational change aspect of Agile. And definitely not in that kind of simplified sort of way. So forget that you need good leadership support, you need good communication, which is, duh, of course you need that. But no one's really stripping down all that stuff. Do you want to do a book? And I did nothing for a year. And then that eventually turned into the video, live lessons.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So just to give your podcast a quick shout out and some self-gratifying information. I was a guest with you a couple months ago on the Lean Change Management podcast. And in there, you I believe it was in there. Maybe it was something I read that you had put out there, but you talked about your early days going to the change management type conferences, and all these guys are wearing nicely pressed shirts with ties, some of them probably jackets. And here you are, the agile practitioner showing up, probably not dressed unlike how all three of us are right now dressed. So I guess, do you consider yourself more associated with the change management world or the agile realm, or are you truly a hybrid? How do you position your stance in those two disciplines? Or is there a difference?
I don't think there's too much of a difference, in the sense that there seems to be more of a trend in the agile community to look towards change in OD communities. And while that's happening, people in those communities are kicking the tires on agile. So they're kind of naturally crossing each other. And I'm sort of in the white space between it, helping people connect to people that have that might be in a different community, but share the same fundamental beliefs that change is going to happen the way it's going to happen. And we facilitate it. We don't control it. But there's great ideas in HR. HR gets kicked around a lot, especially in agile circles, as being the root of all evil. But there's a lot of good ideas in HR. There's a lot of good ideas in traditional change and agile and organizational development worlds. So I'm trying to sit kind of in the middle of that and help people see that as much as we think we keep inventing things in the agile community, we're just rehashing stuff that's 50, 60 years old. With different words. So we all have the same kind of mindset and stance and approach. We might just need a small little jiggle or an idea or a little model or something that's going to help us get a change unstuck. So
nice.
I'm kind of in the middle of all of it, I guess.
Nice. I guess, I'm sorry, Jay, that I'm wrapping.
That's fine.
So lean change management, we did a pretty good job framing out what traditional change management was and where that applies to organizations. What does lean change management bring to the conversation that warranted its own book that traditional change management did not address?
The original intent was just to tell the story about what happened in that organization. So the group of us that were working as part of that change, there were 12 of us, there were 6 employees and 6 consultants, how we just made stuff up to try and get the change to work by taking ideas from all over the place and mashing them up. So I thought it'd be a good story to tell. And then the story kind of wrapped itself in that insights, options, experiments, which is same as build, measure, learn, which is the same as plan, do, check, act. It's framed in a way that gets people with a more traditional background, if they see it as a model and as a thing, it opens their mind up into, well, there might be a different way to do this. So, you know, an example might be change communication is a big thing in the traditional world. We need to make sure we're communicating the change, you know, 21 times or whatever it is, so people remember it and listen. And we need our risk mitigation strategy and all these things that sound good. When they learn that they could use Lean Coffee instead of a SharePoint site, it just blows their minds. So if we can use dialogue instead of communication, because communication is usually one-way broadcast, whereas Lean Coffee is what brings out the deeper conversations, because it has just enough structure to help get you where you want to go, but it doesn't leave you without any structure. So
it's interesting. Are you familiar with Zach Boniker? He's an agile coach out of San Diego.
The name sounds familiar, yes.
Yeah, so he's pretty active in, you know, the different social conversations and such. And he was at an Agile, it might have actually been a Scrum gathering, coaching camp. And he started a conversation about inflicting versus inviting folks into the transformation.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's very much part and parcel with what you're talking about here, about leveraging Lean Coffee as a tool to provide vision, purpose, and safety to those that are impacted by the change itself.
Yeah. And a lot of the even traditional people I talk to share the same mindset, but the tool sets that they've learned are all about, are more based in project management thinking and linear thinking and control-based type of thinking. Mm-hmm. But their personal beliefs are that stuff never works. But there's nothing else for us. So once they see a feedback-driven type of, and they can call it a model, In the book, I even say, I don't know if it's a framework or a model or a method, and I don't really care. It's just a whole bunch of ideas that gives you enough. You could build your own change framework that could be as loose or as firm as you need it to be. And then when they see that's a thing, then now they can actually say, well, okay, here's how I could change the stance about how we approach change in our organization. So putting the word lean in front of change management creates an association where, oh, how could we make change management more lean? What's a technique? I think that's how we learn. We learn a technique and we try the tool and then we kind of tweak it to our needs. So,
and when all else fails, wrap it around a canvas, right?
Yeah, oh God. Yeah. That's, yeah.
I think Jason, what stuck with me in your book was, you know, you just talked about methods and frameworks and whatnot. A lot of traditional project management comes down to risk, right? Is everybody has that whole, I think your quote was, and I have my copy here all bookmarked and whatnot. And your quote was, if you rely solely on plans, you're planning to fail, which is just, that's a dovetail off of Eisenhower's plans are useless. Planning is indispensable, right? It seems to me like a lot of people, they're reluctant to change. They're reticent to change because they're worried about the risks contained therein. And the eye opening for me, I mean, I don't know if it was for you, Ryan, but the eye opening for me as I was working my way through your book was a lot of the procedures that you prescribe really do have a lot with open communication that reduces risk because everybody's talking at the same time and everybody's collaborating. And I really think the biggest driver behind people wanting to use waterfall methodologies is they're nervous about risk. And we all know being in the trench that the best plan in the world doesn't eliminate risk. It's those unknown unknowns that always get you. And Brian's point, I like wrapping in a canvas and whatnot. Makes life a little bit less stressful.
Yeah. And it's funny, all the traditional change methods out there, they just call them templates, but templates are cool. Canvases are cool.
Yeah.
It sounds dumb, but it's like people in the traditional world seem to, you know, if you can say, hey, look, we're using a canvas that, you know, Lean Startup and innovation programs use for our change, it buys you a little bit of association to, okay, I kind of get we're going to run this change a little bit of a different way. So just by using a different lexicon, you buy yourself a bit of time as a change person to try with some new ideas.
It also helps frame the mindset, right? Labels do matter. As much as we pretend sometimes that they don't, the way that you look at things, the way that you introduce things, and to your point, like the lexicon or the glossary, the terms that you start sharing with each other, if you start showing progress in that language, then you are starting to make that progress with the change movement itself. So in your book, you talk about change promoters and change resistors. And just for I think it's pretty obvious, but a change promoter is somebody that's going to get behind the change that you're introducing into the organization and be a cheerleader and somebody help move it along, whereas a suppressor is the opposite. How do you, when you're working with an organization or when you're introducing a change, how do you approach the suppressors? Are there tips, are there tools, are there tricks that you have?
Usually by not focusing on it as much as we like to. You've seen the version one studies that change resistance is one of the top three reasons why change doesn't work. And the same thing happens in the change communities too. We immediately go to the negative and the people who aren't supporting it and try to figure out how to overcome it. I have a bit of a different stance now from what would have been in the book. I don't use the term resistance anymore. It's more, there's just a response. There's only a response to that change, and everybody's going to be at different levels and intensities with whatever that change is. So focus on the supporters who will virally spread it through the organization. So that, you know, the innovators or the early adopters are going to want to hear from me as the consultant, but the early majority, late majority, they don't want to hear from the change person or the consultant. They want to see other people in the organization who are part of the same tribe who got the change to work. And then they'll sort of come along. So I like to focus on trying to help virally spread the positive aspects of the change. And then there's a school of thought that you bring who is perceived as your strongest resistor to be part of the change initiative because they're going to keep you honest, right? If you get a bunch of agile mindset people in a room, it'll be awesome, but we'll miss a lot of obvious stuff because we don't have a counterbalance. We don't have a counter argument that says, yeah, well, what about this? What about that? So we'll kind of run amok and it will be cool and we'll make some progress, but there isn't a natural friction. So I generally like to always start from the positive side first and find the supporters and then find out how the supporters can be part of a change network that can help it spread virally. The strong suppressors are going to opt out anyway. So the people who really want no part of it are going to quit. The ones that really want no part of it, they'll do the bare minimum they need to comply with it. That's just the way it's going to work. We're never going to convince people that one way is better than another if they've got really strong beliefs. So focus on the ones that want to do it and enable them.
So I've had the privilege of speaking with you a few times now, and I believe every time we've spoken, there's been one thing that there's been plenty of things that are a thread through all the conversations. But one thing that just sticks out in my head right now is your concept of, or your observation of the counter movement. And I think there's some value in taking a second and stepping into that. Why is that such a theme when you talk about change or when you talk about growth? You tend to always like to talk about the counter movement. I'm curious where that comes from.
It's because it's sort of how, at least in an agile context, how the change is going to work anyway, especially in medium and larger organizations. So there's somebody that's been tapped on the shoulder with creating an agile process. And then there's a bunch of people that stand to lose something because of that. So they create something that's counter to it. Mm. And then you end up, you've got these poor teams trying to deliver stuff being pulled in two different directions because two different groups are basically having a pissing contest with each other about who can make the best process. Mm. It's sort of a natural way that change works because not everybody is going to agree with it. They'll have different sets of beliefs. They're going to have different sets of past experiences that say their way is the right way. And they're going to work hard to make sure that their view of the truth becomes the view of the truth for the organization. And they'll be at odds with each other. Right. So, one organization I worked at, say we want to, we showed everybody the Spotify videos and now we want to do that. And the first question the people ask is, are we allowed to wear jeans now? So you're nowhere near, you're saying we want this mindset culture shift, but you're getting a group to create a better standardized practice and process for all your teams. It doesn't make any sense. So the folks who hear the culture thing and like it are going to run one way and completely undermine the process group that's running with it a different way because they see things differently. So there's always these movements that are dancing with each other. And you
think that friction is healthy and positive, I'm gathering?
To a point, yeah. I mean, when it gets to a point where it's literally just a status contest where somebody has to win for the other people to lose or the zero-sum game, it's not healthy. But there needs to be, especially in regulated environments, right? You could get away with very little to no documentation in an agile process, even though, that's not what the manifesto means. But you could, sure, you could. If you bought into collective code ownership and you bought into what is in BDD, which is it should be your code is your spec, it is your documentation, then you could get away with it. But you get a strong fear in those regulated organizations that it's almost like the back to school movie with Rodney Dangerfield where he gets the person to write the paper for him.
Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah. He's like, not heavy enough. Give me 3 more pounds. So there's some safety in having that smoke and mirror effect. So we need to be aware that it might be a waste of time, but it might be good waste because you'll never have the auditors on your back. If you only have one page of documentation, they may become suspicious that you're not doing due diligence. So it's more just weighing those pros and cons and sort of agreeing on a path to move forward versus, well, that's not agile type of nonsense.
Right.
So Jason, what is the one thing that leaders need to know about effective change, but in your experience, what's the one thing they should know, but they typically get wrong?
I think they do know. I think they are just too far removed from the day-to-day reality, and might be a little hesitant to go find out what that reality is, because it depends when you say leader what you're talking about. So if you're talking about, you know, C-level leader, you can never say I don't know at that level. You can never, you know, vulnerability and all this stuff is starting to become more popular in the leadership and executive world. A friend of mine, Paul Gibbons, likes to say 10 years ago, you say vulnerability in the boardroom and you get laughed out and you'll get thrown out. But nowadays we're talking about that stuff. So I think these aren't stupid people running our organizations. They know what to do, but there's something about the environment that's preventing them from going to see. So it's sort of like, you know, Agile talks about self-organization. And then if the leader comes to the team, they're being micromanagey, or they're pushing, or they're, you know, if a leader wants to show up at the sprint demo, a VP wants to show up at a sprint demo, or see what happened in the retrospective, Agile says, no, you need to stand back and you can't do that. Then if they're not there, the Agile community says, well, they're not supporting it. So it's almost like these executives who have high stress jobs can't win no matter what they do. And I think they know. I think it's a matter of really just trying to understand what's the company that they want to create.
So I want to officially log a complaint against your book, your publisher, and yourself right now. as you were talking, I jumped to look at the index, and there is no index to make me look like I know what I'm talking about. But you talk about leaders having not willing necessarily to do the go and see. And the word that I jumped to the index to look for is to see if you talk about Gemba walks. Being as it's under the moniker of lean, Gemba being one of the lean practices for continuous improvement. I don't remember that in the book. It's been at least a year since I've actually read it. Is it something that you support? Do you reframe a Gemba walk itself, or is it something that you just did not include in the book or in your practice?
I think it's in the Kata canvas section, I think.
Okay.
I mentioned in there, so I give credit to where the A3 problem solving report came from, which was dude from Toyota will never read past the first page and they'll always go see. So that's where it was called the Gemba walk. But it's more about having the conversation about options, because if you look at lean and you look at system thinkers, they say, no, leaders, they have to go see. That's the one truth. That's the one rule. So then when I'm talking to folks, we have the conversation around, okay, how outside the norms is a Gemba walk? So let's just say that a VP decides they're going to walk the floor and see what's happening. Is the culture kind of set up for people are going to go for their heads out of the cube and go, people are about to be fired. He never, ever comes around here. So is that going to make it worse? It's a good thing to go see, but you kind of have to go about that the right way, because there's the more disruptive, abrasive approach, which is just go do it and blow the ship up and see what happens. And then there is the more vulnerable side, which is, I think I've lost touch with what's going on, and can I come and attend your demo, or can I come and attend this? So you do the same thing. It's more the stance and the approach that you use to ease into it. So it's, you're choosing whether or not to, how disruptive you want to be when you try to make this shift. Because some organizations will not react very well to it. And some organizations, they want to have a disruptor create a whole bunch of problems and kick all the dust up in the air and then sort it out afterwards.
So I guess going backwards a little bit in the conversation, if you were handling your communication plan, to use my project management language, by way of lean coffees, that's something that you would talk about in lean coffee, that you may see some of the senior leadership a little bit more engaged on the floor, but here is why, right?
Yeah. So, and those executive sponsored lean coffees, they're not new. So the traditional world, they do CEO roundtables or whatever they are, but it's the approach that is taken is different. So usually the change team curates the questions and then they make it look like it's for optics, that it's this organic coffee chat type of thing, but the questions are already primed. So showing leaders that don't do that. go in there blind and deal with the hard questions. Because that, if you're serious about wanting to make a shift in the culture, that's the first thing you need to do. People see right through the optics. They see right through the easy answers. And one session I did, the CTO was on the stage, and we had three screens, and on the two side screens were the questions that were being asked live from the audience using this tool, and it was anonymous, so it would be safe. And somebody asked, "Well, we keep hearing how you think things should change. What are you prepared to change?" And he answered it, and he didn't bullshit the audience. And I went, "Okay, these guys are going to make it." So it's having the courage to do stuff like that. Because that's what is going to move people forward.
That's a lucky organization.
Yeah, seriously.
Yeah.
I'd love to have a leader like that. Jason, who do you inquire your inspiration from?
Whole bunch of people. Jen Fram, who's based in Australia. She, I guess, comes from more of the quote unquote traditional background, but she's awesome. She has a really good blog called Conversations of Change. She's done a lot of work in the agile space too, and she's kind of in the white space as well. So she's coming to this, reaching more into the agile community as well, but she's somebody that gets it and has, when I talked to her, I met her last year, the types of changes that she works on, I can't even comprehend. They're just, you know, dealing with so many different global cultures all over the world, massive systems implementations, and her blog's fantastic. Paul Gibbons, who wrote the book The Science of Successful Organizational Change, his book is fantastic because he's a self-professed math geek. Huh. So he gets into a lot of this 70% of changes fail, which is not true, and all that stat is wrong. He's great. Heather Stagel, who's based in Atlanta as well. She's got a really good blog at inclaria.com. And it comes from all over the place, really. Keeping an open mind to people who come from coaching backgrounds, HR backgrounds. Rena Hellstrom is another one from People Geeks, who is pretty inspirational for me because she's coming more from the integrating Agile into HR as well. So it's having a broad enough network and audience to bounce ideas off of is what I get, where I get the most benefit from.
So let me ask you the same question, but with a little bit of a left-hand turn. So where do you get inspiration or ideas from that's not in the Agile change management IT space? Like, what, I guess, like an outside interest. I mean, we were joking before we started about hockey, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever read like a Barry Melrose column and said, "Oh, you know what? Maybe we should try the penalty box for people who screw up changes." Like, where do you pick up ideas from outside your traditional IT circle of influence?
Oh, that's a good one. The creepy answer is people watching. So it's fun. It's fun to watch how a change in society. I mean, being in America, you guys have a front row seat to the Trump effect, right?
Yeah.
So when all of this stuff was going on in the world, nobody gave a shit until Trump came in the way he came in, and then it created, when we talk about these counter movements, right? Mm-hmm. Now you've got all these people who are trying to create more movements to do good things in the world. It's kind of, you know, organizational change mimics the way social change happens. So when you kind of just watch how change in society happens, you learn a lot about what makes things work in our organizations. You know, what happens when you're on the train platform and the train's late, or it stops like a foot away from where it normally does during rush hour. People who are in that status quo and ritual, they stand in the same spot every day, they lose their minds.
Oh, you should you follow me on Twitter. You see what I say when that happens.
Yeah. But it just helps to sort of draw the parallel in our organizations that if I'm the change person trying to bring something in, and 24 hours, 7 days a week, all I'm thinking about is how to make this change work. No one else in the organization is thinking like that. They're worried about their day job. So I need to make sure my messaging is really simple. And I'm looking for the windows of opportunity to jump through to sort of enable those changes. And So it's all, and oddly enough, stand-up comedy is a good place to learn about change. And it's about, you know, a couple of my favorite stand-up guys are, it was George Carlin, obviously, and Louis C.K. about how they deal with their material. They throw everything away at the end of the year and start over from nothing. So, which is really a strong feeling of courage, right? So you create your own sense of urgency by putting yourself in a position that forces you to take action. And when we look at what happens, you know, in business and change, it's we need to create urgency for change. But my urgency isn't your urgency. You know, if you're paying me a bunch of money to come in and bring Agile in, my urgency is doing what I promised I could in my small time period. Your urgency is something totally different. And I don't create your urgency. You create your urgency. So by just being aware of, you know, what's going on in the world and how people respond to change, it helps figure out different ways to approach it.
So two quick thoughts on that, the last probably 5 minutes of conversation. First, I'm so excited to see the Twitter feed now that you brought Trump into a podcast. I can't wait to see how many people we're going to get yelled at. You should have supported Trump. And others are going to be like, you should have smashed Trump. So I'm just staying in the middle like I do at the family dinner. the other thing is when you were talking about where you draw your inspiration from, there was a name that I think I was expecting you to say. And I was a little surprised you didn't. I'm curious if it was an oversight or if it's if there's something else. And it was John Cotter.
I wouldn't say there's good ideas, but when you look at the 8 steps, they're from the mid-90s. And most of the traditional audience have moved on from that. And that's just a basic foundational understanding of 8 good ideas. But as far as inspiration, I don't find it's very inspirational. Daryl Connor, probably more so, because he is arguably the godfather of change management, if you will. And his whole idea is around meaningful change. That if you're doing change work and you're not in it for doing something that's meaningful for people, then you shouldn't be in this profession, get out, is sort of his stance. So it's much more inspiring to hear that even if you're working on an IT project, you're building an IT system to make somebody's day job better. That's the purpose, not saving $50 per transaction on licensing fees or whatever it is. So Daryl's messaging is pretty inspirational too.
Well, Jason, I think we're coming to the end of our scheduled time, and we want to respect the time box that we set with you. So, you're a busy man, and you're involved in quite a few things. So other than going out and getting Lean Change, getting their own copy of Lean Change Management, how should our listeners get a hold of you? Is there any upcoming events that you're interested in sharing with the listeners?
Sure. Twitter's a good way. So it's just at Jason Little. A couple of events. So I'm organizing Spark the Change in Toronto, which is small conference. We limit it to about 120, where we get people from Agile, Change, HR, and OD all in the same room to share ideas about how to build resilient organizations. So that's happening in Toronto in June. I'm chair for the On Agile virtual conference this year, so this will be the third one. And it's agilealliance.org. There's a link there to find out more about that virtual conference. And leanchange.org is the site with all the stories and stuff from the book. And it's not about the method and the tools and stuff, but there's a bunch of guest bloggers that just tell stories about how they're using modern practices for change. And sometimes it's ideas from the book and sometimes it's not. But it's more about trying to build the community and build a bigger network for people that want to upgrade their change skills and stuff. So.
And it always seems like you're doing a lean change management workshop somewhere in the somewhere on this giant spinning orb.
Yeah, it's funny. There's had one scheduled for San Francisco, didn't sell one ticket in May, I had two scheduled in Belgium and the Netherlands, and they're already both sold out already.
And didn't you have one in Finland that sold out in some ridiculously short window?
Yeah, we had to add another one. So I don't know what it is. They just they don't work in North America as much as they do overseas. Canada too. I'm doing one in Vancouver in a couple of weeks. But they're much more popular elsewhere in the world as opposed to North America for some reason.
Well, it gets you to bump up your airline priority boarding. So
yeah,
voluntary first class. So I'm going to take us out of here, Jason. Thank you very much for your time on behalf of Brian and myself, the group, and all of our listeners. I think this was an awesome conversation. I know we could go another hour easily. And that's before you two start talking about hockey and I get a brain aneurysm. So thanks again for your time. To all our listeners, thank you very much. On behalf of Ryan and myself and the group, we appreciate your continued support. Find us, as always, at coalition.agileuprising.com. Once again, this is Jay Hersko. Thank you very much and enjoy your evening.